You are listening to the Middle East Institute's podcast series. To support MEI's programs and podcasts, please donate at www.mei.edu. Thank you for your support.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Kate Seeley, Senior Vice President of the Middle East Institute, and I'd like to welcome you to today's event, examining future U.S.-Iran policy in a shifting regional order. It's very gratifying to have such a large audience here today in this rain, so thank you very much for your interest. Our expert panelists will explore ways the next U.S. administration may want to approach U.S.-Iran policy against a backdrop of growing regional conflicts and challenges to the traditional Gulf security system, Iran's role in the region, and the U.S. response to it has been a topic of much heated conversation here in Washington of late, and I look forward to hearing different sides of the debate today with an eye toward the future and the implications of Iran's regional role and actions for core U.S. interests going forward. So many thanks to our all-star panel for having this conversation with us, and thanks as well to our moderator, who is an Iran expert in her own right. Indira Lakshmanan is a veteran foreign policy journalist and currently a contributor to Politico magazine. She's a frequent guest commentator on PBS's Washington Week, the NewsHour on NPR and on MSNBC, and you may also know her as a guest host of the Diane Rehm Show. Indira will lead a 50 to 60 minute conversation with the panelists, followed by an audience Q&A. And before I hand over the reins to Indira, I just want to say we're having a little bit of problem with our wireless, for those of you who want to tweet, but that should be resolved soon. So keep on hold. So thank you, Indira, and to our panelists, the floor is all yours.
Thank you so much. Well, that's a very kind introduction, and we have an incredible panel here. I don't want to waste too much time bragging about their resumes, since all of you know who these guys are, but they are pretty amazing, so let me do a little bit of bragging on their behalf. Sitting next to me is Vice Admiral John Miller, who was Deputy Commander to U.S. Naval Forces Central Command, the U.S. Fifth Fleet, and Chief of Staff of U.S. Central Command, a long and very distinguished career in the U.S. Navy. Next to him is Dennis Ross, who is a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. And prior to that, he spent 2 years as a special assistant to President Obama on the National Security Council and pretty much was his top advisor on Iran at the time. And as many of you know, Ambassador Ross previously worked in both the George H.W. Bush and Clinton administrations, has a long history advising many presidents. Next to him is Alex Vitanka, who's a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute and focuses on Iran. And unlike, sadly, many of us in this room, Alex has something over all of us, which is he reads and speaks Farsi and is able to directly read what is coming out of the Supreme Leader's mouth and all of the important news organs out of there. So he's going to give us a really special perspective. And at the end of our table, rounding us out, is Paul Pillar, who I maybe have known the longest on this panel from when I was a foreign correspondent. He's had a three-decade career in the U.S. intelligence community and was last serving as National Intelligence Officer for Near East and South Asia. Paul has written many books, many reports. He is a non-resident fellow at the Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence at the Brookings Institution, and you've also read him in the National Interest. So, a great panel of folks to listen to on this subject. I want to start out with something that many of you have seen probably in the news overnight, and is that is the report of a senior Hezbollah commander having been killed in Syria. And the reason I want to begin with this is because it certainly draws attention to the question of what a lot of people have referred to as a proxy war going on in Syria and other proxy conflicts in the Middle East, with, of course, Iran backing Hezbollah. So, Admiral Miller, you know, this adds on to just last week, Iran having threatened to close the Strait of Hormuz, something they have threatened before, and there were recent ballistic missile tests. So I want to ask you how you see Iran's behavior in general in the region in the aftermath of the deal that was signed last July, the nuclear deal, and how do you think the U.S. should be reacting to what some say is increased regional instability?
Well, thanks for the question, Dara. It's great to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity. So one of the things we see routinely from the Iranians whether they are having what they deem to be strategic success or failure, as we see activity out of the IRGC that is, out of the norm for what a nation state would do. So let's look at what they've done since the JCPOA came into effect. You know, we've seen a number of ballistic missile tests. They routinely conduct 4 to 5 ballistic missile tests a year historically. So, we'll have to look at the whole year put into context to see if they're above the norm or below the norm. But they've also done a number of other things. You know, they conducted some rocket firings in the Strait of Hormuz, in the confines of the Strait of Hormuz, which is out of the norm. And they did it while one of our aircraft carriers was doing a straight transit. That's unusual activity. They took a couple of riverine boats and 10 sailors hostage. That's above the norm. So that's the kind of activity that we don't like to see and we don't expect to see. So, you know, they saw some success with the signing of the JCPOA, and we've seen the IRGC act in ways that we don't find normal. We look at the activity that they're undertaking today in Syria, and when Hezbollah acts in Syria, we ought to see that as Iranian activity, because Hezbollah, for all intents and purposes, is a wholly owned subsidiary of Iran. And so we shouldn't be surprised that they're going to take losses in Syria. We've seen the Iranians take losses, and what kind of patience the Iranian people have for that remains to be seen. And we've seen Hezbollah take losses in Syria. What kind of patience the Lebanese people have for that remains to be seen. But that kind of activity, if we expect the Iranians to sort of be welcomed back into the global community, that kind of activity doesn't lend toward that happening. And so part of what we ought to be looking for in the wake of the JCPOA is activity that would help them return to the community of nations, and we're simply not seeing that.
Dennis, you know many of the people who were involved in crafting the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action on the American side, especially. And I'm curious, you know, there were sort of, we had the sense, we reporters who covered the deal, that Secretary of State John Kerry had a feeling that this deal was going to pave the way for better relations with Iran in general. He never came out and said, this is now going to be a new era. He never came out and said, the U.S. and Iran are now going to have detente, nothing like that. But he certainly suggested at press conferences that he was hopeful that now Iran would be more cooperative with the U.S. on ending the conflict in Syria and on a number of other issues, Yemen. He was certainly seemed to be hopeful about that. Let me ask you, from your perspective, what should we have expected from the Iranians after the deal? And, what should we be counting on? Are people wrong when they think that it was paving the way for a new era?
Well, let me answer this in sort of two ways. One, relating to the core of the question, which is what should we have expected? And as opposed to what we may or may not have expected, but also what it may mean over time. My expectations of what Iran's behavior was going to be in the immediate aftermath or the short-term aftermath of the deal was always low. And the reason I say that, for the Supreme Leader, he has an ideology that is built on hostility towards the United States. The deal itself sends a message that, well, maybe something's changing. You know, he didn't acquiesce, he didn't allow this deal to be achieved because he wanted it to be a transformation with us. Obviously, this was designed to get sanctions lifted. So given the nature of his ideology, number one, given the IRGC opposition, number two, given his frequent desire to be above the fray, I always expected that he would compensate the IRGC in the aftermath of the deal. I always expected that he would seek to demonstrate that his ideology hadn't been changed one iota. If you look at every statement he's made since the deal, you look at the tweets, the response to Rafsanjani when he talked about dialogue as opposed to ballistic missile tests, what you've seen is a higher degree of hostility, a constant refrain over our bad faith. None of that came as a surprise to me. I do believe that the administration hoped that there would be a change. I think what you were describing in terms of what was kind of the subtext of what Secretary Kerry was saying was a reflection of, look, we now have these diplomatic channels. And in fact, the administration said when they got the sailors released, well, because we had diplomatic channels, we were able to do this. That's a fact. There is an
Which
ability.
The U.S. Navy sailors right. who were held on the boat
right.
and then released.
That Admiral Miller was referring to. There is a channel of communication that we have that we didn't have before. But that allows you to deal with, in a sense, immediate tactical questions. The larger strategic question is there a potential for longer term change with the Iranians? And I would say in the near term, probably not. Over time, I think what the administration had hoped for is you do the deal and you empower this more pragmatic constituency within Iran. You know, that's remains to be seen whether that is going to happen or not. We can obviously get into a discussion of what the elections suggest. I don't believe the elections suggest that somehow the moderates are doing better because most of them weren't allowed to be candidates anyway. What I think you saw in the elections was those who were opponents of Rouhani didn't do well because Rouhani does kind of embody a set of hopes and I think aspirations of the public for life getting better. Rouhani doesn't take on, he's not trying to liberalize the society inside because he knows he's limited in terms of what he can do there. The larger question is if the Islamic Republic becomes integrated into the international financial system, which could be the result of this deal. Obviously, we can get into why it takes time for that to take place. Maybe that can affect the balance of power within Iran over time. Maybe it affects the incentives on their part not to engage in behaviors that could threaten their capacity to continue to get the benefits of being integrated into the international financial system. All that, I think, remains to be seen because what you see in the near term are a set of behaviors that run counter to that. They have become, I think, not just Admiral Miller in terms of what you said, I think we've seen regular Iranian forces actually committed to Syria, not just the Al-Quds forces, not just the IRGC. We're not seeing a lessened level of activity in the region. I think even the behaviors within Iraq right now, or in my mind at least, again suggest a kind of determined position of the IRGC. And so what I see in the near term is what I expected. You weren't going to see any move towards, I'll use the term, greater moderation. You were going to see an effort to reinforce the imagery of Iran's overall ideological position, certainly the Supreme Leader's. And you weren't going to see a fundamental improvement in relations with us. And that shouldn't have come as a surprise, as I said, given who the Supreme Leader is, given how he tries to manage that system.
Dennis, you brought up a number of threads that I want to pick up on later in our discussion. Of course, you mentioned Iran and the banking system. We can get back to the op-ed that Stuart Levy, the former Treasury Undersecretary, now with HSBC Bank, wrote in today's Wall Street Journal. I do want to get back to that. But, you know, you the thread of what you're saying is that Rouhani himself even is not really a moderate. It's just about the spectrum. And it reminds me of Wendy Sherman, who, of course, other than John Kerry, was the main negotiator of the nuclear deal, having said publicly that after the deal was done that, you know, no, Rouhani's not a moderate. None of them are moderate. Zarif's not a moderate. It's just a question of how I don't know if the word radical is the right word to use, but where they are on the clerical spectrum and that we shouldn't be thinking of them as our friends. Alex, I want to turn to you as someone who actually is able to read those tweets from the Supreme Leader and from Rouhani in the original Persian, and tell us what is your sense as we're coming up. We've had these parliamentary elections in Iran, but there's a 2017 presidential election coming up, and I think that Rouhani has backed the nuclear deal insofar as it gives him a sense of stature. He did something important, but is it going to be a noose around his neck for his reelection?
Thank you. If not a noose, then definitely it's going to be something that the Office of the Supreme Leader wants to use as a check on the presidential agenda. Just to follow up on what Dennis just said, since late January, we haven't really had Ayatollah Khamenei say anything good about the nuclear deal, or frankly, much good about President Rouhani and his government. But one thing he hasn't done is to specifically and explicitly say the deal is bad, let's undo it. He hasn't done that. And I think there, that tells me certainly a lot. So when I say he's using the nuclear deal as a way of putting a check on Rouhani, it goes to your point, Indira, about the 2017 elections, because there are folks in the circle of the Supreme Leader who probably would like the idea of a one-term Rouhani administration. Can they get away with it? Remains to be seen. Would Khamenei subscribe to that? Remains to be seen, because turning Rouhani into one-term president involves risking the entire system, basically. I mean, you're not going against someone who is on the margins. You're going against someone who is the other half of the entire establishment that's been there since 1979. That's a huge risk. I'm not sure Khamenei is going to take that risk. But certainly, Khamenei is using the slow implementation, and this is one of the key things to remember if you're looking at this from an Iranian perspective. Right after the IAEA in January gave the go-ahead for the Iranian nuclear part having been done, what happened? The United States imposed sanctions on the missiles front, if you remember. If you were listening to the debate in Tehran, right away they started saying, that's Khamenei's people saying, ah, so the deal that we just signed with him, that meant nothing. They're looking for excuses to impose more sanctions and tougher measures against us. And that's basically been the debate for the last 3.5-4 months in Tehran, where Rouhani will stand up and say, the deal was great. We achieved a lot. And Khamenei and his people will say, actually, to very slow implementation, because as Khamenei likes to say is, oh, I see all these foreign dignitaries come to Tehran. That's great. 8 presidents, 16 foreign ministers in Tehran in the last few months. But where is the tangible benefit on the ground? That's how the fight is going on right now. I think Rouhani is going to push back, as he does. Listen to his speech in the city of Kerman just last week. It's very telling. He says to thousands of people, they, meaning Khamenei and his people, are saying the JCPOA was good for nothing. But he said it opened our hands to do things. That was Rouhani's message. That at least it unshackled us, Iran, that is. But the question for Rouhani then is, let's just say you're unshackled. What are you going to do with it? If you want foreign investment, to the points that were raised, you got to do more than just fixing the nuclear issue. You have to really touch the larger sense of what is the Islamic Republic Iran about. Is it a revolutionary state? Or is the kind of South Korea of the Middle East that Rouhani keeps talking about?
Back on that question about the economy as well, because I think that's a critical point for the nuclear deal, is how much money does Iran see, how does Iran see themselves benefiting financially? And a lot of people in the U.S. administration have said that they must benefit financially or they won't necessarily stick with the terms of the agreement. So that's maybe part of why you see John Kerry going around the world encouraging European banks to actually do business with Iran, despite BNP Paribas having been hit with that $9 billion sanctions settlement, trying to get people over the trauma of that. And obviously not everyone, not all banks are wanting to get over the trauma of that. Paul, you have read all of the intelligence over the years, from the U.S. point of view. So take us a step back from this whole conversation, sort of at the 30,000-foot view. Where are U.S. interests when it comes to the U.S.-Iran relationship? And specifically, you know, we're talking about the shifting regional order. Where do our interests lie in the regional rivalries that involve Iran? And I'm specifically, of course, talking about everything between Saudi Arabia, Iran, and other rivals from Yemen to Syria and beyond. How much should we be involved?
Oh, thanks, Adira. In the most general terms, I would say, as far as the U.S.-Iranian relationship is concerned, our interests are, number one, preventing the sort of clash or violent conflagration, which may involve our forces directly or the forces of Iran and other countries that we're associated with or that are generally considered our partners. It would also extend to having a more secure and stable security system generally in the Persian Gulf region, and obviously Iran has to be a major player in that. And finally, it would extend to being able to work along with Iran, and as we do and as we should with every other country in the region, to pursue our interests in all those various areas where our interests partly conflict and partly converge. And you can go across the whole region and see a mixture with regard to our interests and those of the Iranians. If you want to go back in history, then look at the immediate aftermath of the overthrow of the Taliban and the opening couple of years of Operation Enduring Freedom, our intervention there, in which, as you may recall, there was this golden little window of just a few months after the Taliban was overthrown when U.S. and Iranian diplomats were working very closely together to midwife the birth of a new Afghan political order. There were a lot of hopes raised about how that might lead to something. There were certainly hopes on the Iranian side, but then we declared the axis of evil and the door was slammed shut. I mean, we slammed the door shut. Today you can just look across the region. Afghanistan is still, there are plenty of these interests that are partly convergent, largely convergent. On the other side, Iraq, to only slightly oversimplify, we and the Iranians are fighting on the same side against ISIS and in support of the incumbent regime in Baghdad. And then there are others where clearly the interests are more conflictual, such as Syria, but the Iranians are going to be a major player. And if anything is ever going to be done with regard to winding down, much less resolving, the Syrian civil war, then other outside players, including the Russians and the Iranians, as well as us and several Arab states and the Turks, are all going to have to be thoroughly involved. So I'd say, as far as the relationship with Iran itself is concerned, those are the parameters I see, and I see the significance of the JCPOA in that sense beyond the nuclear aspect, and that's what it has to be assessed as first and foremost, as a nuclear nonproliferation agreement, as one of unshackling our diplomacy, breaking some ice from the days in the not very distant, not very past future, I should say, in which U.S. and Iranian diplomats and officials were not even talking to each other. With regard to those larger rivalries that you also asked about, I would say, number one, my point about conflictual as well as convergent interest applying to everyone does apply to everyone, including ones that are generally considered partners or allies or friends, as well as ones who are generally considered adversaries. It is no surprise that certain states in the region, and you rightly emphasize the Saudi-Iranian relationship as the one that is particularly critical right now, for those governments directly concerned, those are very important relationships and rivalries, more so for them than they are for us, because they live there and we don't. I think our main interests are in seeing to it that those rivalries do not get out of control and take a violent turn. One that would upset lots of people's interests if it affects the oil trade, if it affects U.S. citizens and our military posture in the Gulf, and so on and so forth. I think it's important for us not to see ourselves as the Sunni's lawyer or the Arab's lawyer vis-a-vis the Persians or anyone's lawyer with regard to one side or the other of a nationalist rivalry. I think if you look at the Saudi and Iranian rivalry, there are a couple other points we need to make, Indira. One is, if you're looking at, who has been sort of more aggressive lately, if I can put it in those oversimplified terms, I'd have to say it's the Saudi side, particularly with regard to, what King Salman and more directly the young prince, who is showing his stuff with the highly destructive war in Yemen. In which the Yemen and Emirati role goes way, way, way beyond anything that the Iranians may have provided in terms of material assistance to the Houthis. And then in terms of either one of those powers using military force overtly to put a regime either still in power or overthrow it, then you've got something like Bahrain, which, of course, we consider an ally and a host for our naval presence. But it was the Saudis, not the Iranians, that used military force to keep a minority regime in power. Just one last point. We shouldn't, when we think about these rivalries like the Saudi-Iranian one, we can read in the paper today about how, you know, there's not going to be any Iranian Hajis because they're still understandably upset by almost 500 of the citizens, you know, being killed in the stampede last year. But that's a relationship that's had lots of ups and downs. And you can go back just to the 1990s. I'm not talking about under the Shah. I mean under the Islamic Republic. When Rafsanjani was president, you know, it was much different. You know, there was a genuine rapprochement, and it was nowhere near as hostile as it is right now. I think a lot of this has to do with politics in both places, but probably more the politics in Riyadh with regard to Mohammed bin Salman and what's happening there.
Those of us in Washington can trace it back to the supposed attempted assassination of the Saudi ambassador in Cafe Milano and all the other stuff, not to mention, you know, most recently, Saudi Arabia's execution of the Shiite cleric Nimr al-Nimr that precipitated all of the protests and the, on the Saudi embassy and the severing of relations. So, Admiral Miller, I want you to, you know, take your long, long experience in the U.S. military and drill down for us a bit on how you see Iran utilizing, sort of using instability in the Middle East to further their own interests in their efforts to get regional hegemony. Now, as Paul points out, it may have been the Saudis who more recently are being more aggressive, but that, you know, doesn't help this cycle. So drill down for us on whether you see it as more the Iranians and more the Saudis who are triggering off this regional instability right now. And also, since the nuclear deal was signed, what specific things has Iran done differently militarily, or how do you see them behaving militarily in the future? And specifically, I'm interested in, I think it was you or Dennis who was talking about the Iranian regulars being actually involved in the conflict, not just their proxies and Hezbollah. And I wonder how much body count the Iranians are actually going to be able to sustain. How many bodies of their own people do they want to lose in this conflict in Syria?
Well, thanks. The ambassador actually talked about Iranian regulars being involved in the conflict in Syria, and that's in fact true. Although it's interesting when you look at the forces that they're losing there, they're very senior forces. So you know they're not sending conscripts to go fight in Syria. They're sending very senior forces. But let me talk about Iran as a force of instability in the region. And I think they, in fact, are, and in many cases, the force of instability. Not to detract from Paul's point about what, you know, some of the recent adventurism of the Saudis, which in many cases is a result of a lack of U.S. leadership in the region. I think because, you know, we've to a large extent failed to exert leadership in places like Yemen, and we've left the Saudis and the Emiratis in many cases to their own devices, and so you know they're off doing what they're doing, and we're left to deal with the consequences. But specifically, Indira, to your point about Iran as a force of instability, you know we've got many examples of what they've done. If you go back to March, April of 2015. And go to Yemen as an example. The Saudi or the Iranians took part in what was a very public attempt to deliver lethal aid to Yemen, and they had a large convoy of ships headed towards Yemen, trying to deliver lethal aid. And if it weren't for the efforts of the U.S. Navy, they would have been able to do so. And because they weren't able to do so, they turned that convoy around. But what followed almost immediately thereafter was a series of events in inside the Gulf, where they harassed and attacked merchant shipping in order to attempt to, you know, sort of save face from this very public humiliation that they faced trying to deliver lethal aid. So that was a rather public display of instability. They attacked the Mersk Kensington in April of 2015. Excuse me, followed by the taking of of the Mersk Tigris. This was a ship that was a merchant ship transiting the Strait of Hormuz. They ordered it into Iranian territorial waters and took the ship under the guise of a
a claim that was being adjudicated in the international courts and effectively held it hostage. You know, it's not possible for a state to commit an act of piracy, but if it were, this would have been effectively an act of piracy. And they held it ransom for about $3.5 million. And that was followed by another act of an attack on a merchant ship that had an elision or collision, if you will, with an Iranian oil platform that was under construction, that had pulled into Bahrain for repairs, got underway to go to Dubai for further repairs. This is again in April of 2015. They attacked it in international waters. The ship sailed into Emirati waters, and if it weren't for the efforts of the Emirati Coast Guard chasing away the IRGC, they would have taken this ship as well. So those are all very irresponsible but public acts of the IRGC. You look at other things that Iran has done or been held responsible for. You go back to 2012, and it's the cyber attacks on Qatari's RasGas company and Aramco. You look at lethal aid shipments. The Fifth Fleet has intercepted several in the last couple of months coming out of Iran, ostensibly headed towards Yemen. You look at weapons shipments that were intercepted on their way into Bahrain that were tied directly to Iran. And these are significant weapon shipments with plastic explosives, detonators for very sophisticated IEDs that were intended to reach the island of Bahrain to be used against the civilian population or against the Bahraini police forces. There are numerous examples, and Dara, you mentioned yourself the attempted assassination of the Saudi ambassador here in Washington, D.C. So the Iranians have a number of ways where we have seen them try to foster instability in the region, whether it be the eastern province of Saudi Arabia, whether it be against Bahrain, whether it be in Kuwait, whether it be asymmetrically or with the U.S. Navy. There's an example that goes back to 2007 where they captured about 15 British sailors, held them hostage for a couple of weeks, and they were in what the U.K. maintained were international waters, where the Iranians maintained were Iranian waters. But by and large, I think we have a number of examples where they've acted as a force of instability in the region. And so those activities are not activities of a responsible nation state. And I think what we need to see out of Iran is if they want to rejoin the community of nations in the world and in the region, they need to back away from those sorts of activities. And then, of course, they need to back away from statements, as we just heard from the IRGC deputy commander the other day, where they're going to close the Strait of Hormuz. The Strait of Hormuz is an international strait, and it's open to everybody. And it's the lifeblood of the entire region, and that includes Iran as well. And it's not just the export of petroleum products, but it's also the import of food. The Emirates, for example, relies on the import of more than 90% of their food supply through the Strait of Hormuz. And other nations are in a similar circumstance. And so those are the sort of things that we see out of Iran that really we need to stop seeing.
Paul Pillar, would you like to respond to that at all? Do you have any thoughts on what the admiral said and what you think U.S. policy should be if these points that he pointed out are indeed correct?
Well, it's not hard at all to come up with some bill of particulars of, Iranian conduct through the years that we don't like, and I know some of the examples date back almost a decade. I think the more pertinent question for us right now, given the topic of this forum, was the JCPOA and effects and non-effects. I think Dennis said some correct things about it's basically too early to tell about some of the longer-term effects on things like Iranian politics. But it's interesting how the expectations game gets played here in Washington, kind of similar to how it's played in our domestic politics in primary season. Where it's, are you beating expectations or not? And I hear all these, a lot of expectation expressed about how, peace should have broken out, in the last 5 months, and of course it hasn't. But more specifically, remember all the expectations, well, the JCPOA was under consideration earlier about how Iran would experience a financial windfall and would be emboldened to do all these nefarious things in the region. And I look at what the record has been so far, And it is, I agree with Dennis very early, I haven't seen any increase in such things at all. We've talked a little bit about Syria. There's apparently been some rotation in terms of, you know, the types of Syrian assets there, but, you know, the report that wasn't mentioned was from a couple of months ago about how the Rev Guard apparently is substantially being or has been drawn down from an estimated 2,500 troops down to about 700. That's not the direction that we were led to expect with regard to, more aggressive Iranian behavior. What the overall levels are now when you figure in the regular troops and so on, who knows? But that report I just mentioned, which was basically corroborated by what Secretary of State Kerry said to a congressional committee, is certainly going in a different direction. And this whole idea of the windfall, you know, funding, bad behavior, there never really was a logic to it. To begin with, and this goes beyond just the kind of the factual errors. You hear these figures of 100 and 150 million. I read Ted Cruz in the op-ed page this morning of the Times, you know, the 100 million figure. Secretary Kerry told us the other day that the amount of frozen assets that have been unfrozen so far, 3 billion. And this doesn't even account for, you know, most of the frozen assets already being accounted for in other accounts. But the main deficiency of that expectation, that argument, was the idea that the Iranians determined their regional policy by counting the number of rials in their bank account and then maxing out their account to do as much as they can regionally. No country behaves that way. The Iranians have given no record of behaving that way. What they've given a record of is responding to things that are going on in Iraq, in Syria, in Yemen, what have you, and doing what they see as being in their interest. If there was a logic to this business about having Iranian regional policy determined by how many rials in their bank account, then we should have seen a decrease in Iranian activity when the sanctions came into effect, and probably a further decrease when oil prices started tanking a couple of years ago. I haven't heard anyone argue that that's the case. So let's try to keep straight here, you know, expectations versus the reality. If I could just say one more thing, Indira, with regard to Yemen, I think it's, to be quite blunt, it's a stretch to really blame this situation, which really is a tragic situation even just from a humanitarian point of view, on things like U.S. leadership. The Saudis have had a very strong fixation with Yemen, you know, the poorer, more densely populated country that it shares the peninsula with a bunch of Zaidi Shiites just across the border for decades. And they were involved in a previous civil war back in the 60s in which the other outside protagonist was the Egyptians. And the Iranians have had absolutely nothing to do with that. The Iranians are no doubt happy to see the Saudis bleed for a while in Yemen, hence some of their material aid to the Houthis. But the Houthis are in no way a proxy for the Iranians. They don't even follow their advice. The Iranians reportedly advised them not to take over Sana'a, but the Houthis said, we're going to do it anyway. So there are ample reasons here that have nothing to do with either Iran or U.S. leadership for seeing much of what we're seeing.
Dennis, I want to pick up on Paul's point about expectations of what would happen after the nuclear deal. And I'm thinking, you know, he mentioned Ted Cruz. There were many members of Congress, not to mention interest groups in this town, both those who supported the deal and those who were against the deal, who very strongly tried to lead the public to believe that the deal, if signed, would, you know, do this good or do this bad. And I think that no discussion about Iran in Washington would be complete this week without talking about the Ben Rhodes profile in the New York Times that we in the group that Ben Rhodes apparently has dubbed the blob have all been talking about for the last 8 days or 9 days since it hit the internet. And I'm very curious about your take on that, since you're the one person at this table who's actually sat in the White House and had different kinds of conversations with Ben Rhodes than the rest of us have had. But specifically, I want to begin by saying that it seemed to me that the author of that article, putting aside what Ben Rhodes said, the author of that article clearly had a point of view against the Iran deal and asserted some things that were just factually incorrect, such as saying that the administration claimed that it only began negotiations with Iran after Rouhani was elected, which was demonstrably false. And I and others have written about the secret negotiations, not to mention the open negotiations led by Bill Burns that had been going on for years. But I want to get your take on what you thought of the article, what Ben Rhodes said about all of us, and whether you what you thought about the depiction of the administration's selling of the deal.
Well, I was able to restrain my enthusiasm for it, because I suspect I probably too was part of the blob. But I'll pick up on a couple of points. First, I think the I understand why those in the media felt sort of put upon, because it was like they were being used and misled and so forth. You know, I think it also the thrust of the article in terms of its real meaning was what it said about the worldview. It was a, in that sense, it was a very good companion piece to the Jeff Goldberg article and description of the Obama doctrine. What comes through is an unmistakable conviction that, that the lessons of Iraq shape fundamentally the view of the president, certainly of Ben, that when they look at the Middle East, they see a place that basically, creates conflicts that can suck the United States in and inevitably will create the equivalent of Iraq, and therefore it's highly costly to us. It's not productive. We can't affect these conflicts and we should be focused elsewhere. Now, to some extent, to get to the Admiral's point about Yemen, I do believe the Saudis acted in Yemen because they were convinced that the administration, fairly or not, was not going to create any limits on what Iran was doing in the region, and therefore they felt they had to create limits. It's true. Yemen isn't, they've always viewed Yemen as being a source of great potential vulnerability for them, and it's true that it goes back to, they saw the coup in 1962 as being driven by Nasser, and then the Egyptians put 70,000 forces in there. And yes, they were heavily involved then, but they sense a vulnerability because of what Yemen can do to them, or what can, how Yemen can be a platform against them. And they read the administration as not being prepared to put limits on Iran. Fairly or not, that's the way they read it. And that, I think, helped trigger their behavior. But these two articles, meaning Goldberg and the Samuels articles, they give you, I think, a fairly accurate portrayal of a worldview, and how the region is perceived right now. And you can, I think it's actually, it ought to be something that could be debated. You know, I myself wrote a piece in Politico in January. I said that I felt that the president had overlearned the lessons of Iraq, that every time he looked at Syria, he was convinced that anything we did would produce a new Iraq. The problem in this part of the world, we don't create them. But the question is, what produces vacuums? Well, and who fills those vacuums? With the Iraq War, there's no question that the Bush administration replaced a regime and had no plan for what was going to come afterwards. And it did create a vacuum, and we've seen who fills the vacuums. In the case of Syria, the hesitancy to be involved, to constantly, at least initially, to avoid, and then later to try to contain, put us in a position where we probably contributed to the creation of a vacuum. And here again, you see the worst forces filling it. Doesn't mean the U.S. can be the answer to everything, but if there's a perception that the United States, is retrenching, and again, it's quite ironic. Today, we have dramatically more force in the region than the Russians do, but the Russians are seen as being prepared, given what they've done in Syria, to change the balance of power on the ground in a way that we're not perceived to be doing that. And it raises questions about us. And obviously the Saudi disenchantment, I think, with the administration was made pretty evident by King Salman not greeting the president at the airport, but greeting every other member of the, every other leader of the GCC at the airport. Again, there's an issue here of what our view of the region is, how they perceive us, and I think what these articles, the two of them, do is reflect that. One other point on the, you know, having, I spoke to 60 members of Congress at their request during the Iran debate. I have, in all my experience, and I go back to actually working on arms control agreements way back when with the then Soviet Union, I do not have in my memory bank any example where I have seen members of Congress so thoroughly study an understanding or agreement. The idea that it was the talking points of the White House that transformed everything, you know, that somehow they manipulated everything. People on the Hill were not reading the talking points. They were reading the agreement, and they studied the agreement. So I think the idea somehow that there was a kind of manipulation of the image and that's what shaped all this, there's a reality that people on the Hill studied it. There was not an affirmative vote. What the administration was able to succeed in doing was to ensure that the agreement wasn't blocked. So since you asked me about the article, I feel like the article, there's the reaction to the article has focused on the language on the 27-year-olds who don't know anything in the press, and therefore you can manipulate them, and you have your journalists who are echo chambers for the administration. Okay, first of all, every administration does that. And secondly, that's not what shaped the study of this agreement. People actually read the agreement. And they made their judgments based on how they read the agreement. I think that I would prefer to see the focus of these two pieces, not just the Samuels one, but the Goldberg one. We should have a debate about what is the right way to think about the region? What is the right role of American power? What are the consequences when vacuums emerge in this region? What responsibility do we have to try to prevent those vacuums? The part of what we're dealing with right now in the region, particularly when we deal with ISIS, is a reluctance on the part of the Sunni tribes and the Sunni states to do everything, and this is why the president was there, at least in part, to do what we would like to see them do vis-a-vis ISIS. Well, part of it is they read Iran as the main threat. We may not have to agree with their perception. We may not have to agree with what their priorities are, but we better understand them. If we don't understand their priorities, we're going to have a pretty hard time affecting their views of us, and clearly, their own behaviors will be influenced by what they think they need to do when they believe that we're not prepared to act on those things that they regard as being important to them.
Dennis, I think you're absolutely right that it was a very interesting other, drill down into the view of the president's view of the Middle East. And I remember your piece from Politico in January that made that same point. And I appreciate your sharing with us that your idea that the 60 members of Congress who you met with personally had actually read the deal and were not being spun by either plowshares or, FDD or Yuani or whoever on all the sides of the issue. That's a very interesting perspective. My own perspective, for what it's worth, from reading that article, is that David Samuels, it appears as a reader, had somehow gained the trust of Ben Rhodes and gotten him to say all these things. But the piece came across to me, and this is not to defend Ben Rhodes, because if in fact he said all those things, that's bad. But it came across as a hit job, as an effort to make Ben Rhodes look bad and make the White House look bad. I'm still stunned that he would say all of those things, including the fact that the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, everyone, all major news organizations do have bureaus in Baghdad and Moscow and London, and not too many of us are 27 years old anymore. But so that was interesting. Although I like the idea. Thank you. Alex, we've got a lot of perspective here on the view from Washington. I want you to take us back to the view from Tehran. And when we're making judgments here, thousands of miles away in Washington, about what Iran wants and what its policy is in the region, et cetera, how solid is that policy consensus? I mean, is it a monolith in Tehran that we need to be behaving this way in Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and other regional flashpoints? Is Rouhani in any way trying to present a more moderated foreign policy? And is he going to confront the IRGC, which is essentially running Iran's regional policies?
Let me answer that question by just picking up on something that was mentioned by everyone on the panel about the Iranian Artesh, the Iranian regular army in Syria. The news came out that, they've had a number of casualties in Syria. And right away, the head of the Iranian regular army, the Artesh, General Saleh, he says, these people were volunteers. There are no conscripts from the Artesh, from the regular Iranian army in Syria. And presumably that's not going to happen anytime soon. Why do I say that? Because put yourselves in the context of what's happening in Tehran politically. I mean, nothing that Iran does in Syria obviously happens in a political vacuum back in Tehran. In fact, it's happening in a very exciting moment in the history of the Islamic Republic, where the 37-year-old Ayatollah Khamenei has now repeatedly in the last few months talked about him leaving the political stage. He's saying, I will be gone soon or one day, which means start thinking about the day after. And people are getting ready. Who's going to take over? Who's going to fill the old man's shoes? So when we talk about Iranian regular army in Syria, some folks in Tehran are saying, knowing what moms and dads in Tehran don't want to see, i.e. their kids being shipped off to Syria, that, look, that's not going to happen. So I think that's important to bear in mind because, frankly, a lot of Iranian foreign policy is tied into domestic politics of the land. I mean, we shouldn't forget that one of the first people to actually get himself executed because of a fallout inside the regime over foreign policy issue died back in 1981 or 82, Sadegh Qutbzadeh, when he met Jimmy Carter's right-hand man, Jimmy Carter, over the hostage situation. So the Iranians have a history of getting themselves, or some of them, getting themselves into trouble based on what they do on foreign policy. And Rouhani certainly wants to stay away from that. And to your point, Indira, about what's Rouhani going to do, he's certainly not going to pick up a fight with the IRGC right now over Yemen, Iraq, Syria. Those are simply too big for now. Not in his first term, not now. He needs more evidence that things are going badly for the Iranians before he can turn around and say to Ayatollah Khamenei that, look, sir, we need to change tact. But debate is going on, and the debate is certainly going on. And when someone like Javad Zarif turns around and tells Robin Wright from The New Yorker, I don't know how many people we have in Syria, he probably means it. The Iranian foreign minister doesn't know how many people they have in Syria. And that's another way of, I guess, answering your question. But Rouhani knows that. Zarif knows that. And they're deliberately going along because they know what they have, as they say, in the toolbox. You fight with what you have. And fighting Khamenei and the IRGC simultaneously right now, when the dividend from the nuclear agreement hasn't really landed yet, it just would be bad timing. But look, if we're talking about the post-nuclear agreement era in Iranian foreign policy, and everybody here talked about the Gulf, and I'll get to that in a second, but travel from, Iran has 15 immediate neighbors. Travel from eastern flank, from Pakistan up north to Central Asia, relations have improved over the last 3 months. Certainly a lot of positive rhetoric coming out of places like Pakistan. Someone like President Ali of Azerbaijan, hardly a fan of the Islamic Republic, has repeatedly made visits. The Turks are not letting their great trade volume with Iran get jeopardized just because of a fallout over Syria. Iraq obviously is Iraq, and some people will tell you that's an Iranian satellite state now. That takes us to one block of nations, the GCC, Gulf Cooperation Council. That's the elephant in the room. That's where the Iranians have made no progress the last 3-4 months. Actually, you could say things have gotten worse. And that, in many ways, if I was asked for my advice by Ayatollah Khamenei, what do I do? I'll say I would tone down some of the rhetoric coming out of Tehran. And I'm not saying the Saudis are not guilty in some of the things they do. They certainly haven't helped the situation. But I'm saying Iran, as the country that is trying to come back into the international mainstream, the largest country by far in the region, 80 million people, and you can list the things that they have going for the country, for the economy, and all the rest of it, they can afford to perhaps do more in terms of overtures to the other side of the Persian Gulf. Paul mentioned the 1990s. That definitely happened. Ali Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani, when he's president, he made efforts, and it led to the resumption of diplomatic relations, because people forget the Iran and Saudi Arabia back in the late 1980s had broken off diplomatic relations. But they managed to very quickly, right after the liberation of Kuwait, to go back and reestablish relations, building up actually something that looked like a decent economic relationship. And amazingly, even cooperated tactically in places like Yugoslavia, helping the Yugoslav Muslims. So things can be done if there is political leadership. But right now in Tehran, Khamenei, and you got to look at the man where he sits. He is God's representative on this earth. That's what the job comes with, right? He's supposed to be defending the Shias. Just imagine for a second at the reaction if he is seen to be weak on what they call the Wahhabi threat to all things Shia or minorities in the region. He can't afford to do that. So he might see it as a dead end and a policy that can be continued, but he can right now be the first one that takes that step. And Rouhani is in a worse situation than Khamenei. Rouhani was the person, the only person in 2013 presidential elections in Tehran who repeatedly said we need to do something with our relations with Saudi Arabia. But now 3 years later, he knows it's politically almost suicidal for him to touch it. But, and I end there. Again, Paul mentioned the Hajj. The Iranians, I can't remember last time a Muslim country, a large Muslim country was told by the Saudis, you can't send your pilgrims here. This is going to have ramifications for the Saudis, by the way, but that's going to take some time. But nonetheless, the Iranians so far have taken it on the chin. The Iranians have taken it on the chin. Again, there's a message here. They haven't, if you go back to Ayatollah Nimr's execution, you remember all the sort of noise that came out of Tehran? Just compare that to the last 2 days. Almost silence. It seems like there is perhaps a tendency in Tehran to think the Saudis are in a hole right now. Let them keep digging. We shouldn't be seen to be the spoilers. Let them do what they're doing and everything else that's going within the kingdom itself in terms of what happens after King Salman. So I think I don't envy Rouhani, frankly. Rouhani knows that a worst case scenario is he invites all these people, all these countries, I mean, that travel to Iran and want to invest in this huge market. South Korea, for the first time, sends its president since relations between Iran and South Korea were established in 1962. Not even a Shah could pull a South Korean leader, and they just had an official visit. The Japanese prime minister, first visit since 1978. United States might not care about that Iranian market, but a lot of the Asians and the Europeans do, and Rouhani knows that. But Rouhani needs to play it very safe. He can't give the other side the excuse to go after him. And I think that's why he stays away from some of the more sensitive regional issues like the Saudi question and so forth.
Not to take issue with the last point you said, but when you say the United States might not care about the Iranian market, I personally know that there are American businesses and multinational corporations who are a little bit peeved that their partners, their, you know, rivals in France and Spain and Italy and Asia, you know, have been encouraged by the Obama administration to go back to Iran because it's part of that dividend that you were talking about from the nuclear deal, but that, of course, the primary embargo continues for U.S. companies who are in themselves not allowed to go back, not allowed to do business. The banks are not allowed to do this. So the funny thing I was talking about today with this Wall Street Journal op-ed by Stuart Levy, any of you, you know, might want to take a look at it, who's now with HSBC, saying, you know, the irony of the American Secretary of State going around and encouraging European banks to do business with Iran when American banks themselves are not allowed to do business with Iran. He's making a separate choice for HSBC, which is they're not going to go in even if it is legal because for them it's reputational risk, concerns about IRGC, et cetera. But you were going to jump in, both of you, I think, Dennis and Alex, on that point.
Dennis, go ahead. Very quickly, and I just want to say in that context of everything you just said, the Islamic Republic is its own worst enemy. You know, you want to bring investor confidence to your economy. You want to play the potential that you have. I mean, people, again, forget, 20th largest economy in the world. It's not a, you know, this is not a small economy. Potentially could be huge. And yet, you know, Rouhani does all the things he has to say. He goes to Davos. His people like Mohammad Nahavandian go to London and encourage confidence. Then in one instance, like picking somebody up in the airport, an Iranian American putting them away, or having missile tests that says rubbish on it, that death to this country, death to that. I mean, it just, you cannot be both. Do you want to be a mainstream economy that can provide for your youth so you can avoid another revolution like the Shah had to face in 79? Or do you want to play the revolution? Pick one. And I think that's where they are. They haven't picked one. Can they? I don't know.
I was going to make some of the same point. Look, there's an old Henry Kissinger line. Iran has to decide, are they a cause or a country? And their problem right now is their banks don't meet international standards. If you've been hit with a big fine, you don't want to be hit with another big fine because you deal with a bank that's engaged in money laundering. If the Iranians aren't prepared to meet those standards, again, it's a choice they're making. I don't know that we have to be defensive when they won't make those kinds of choices.
Brings us back to the sanctions being based on the finding by the Treasury Department that Iran's banking system was an area of primary money laundering concern. All right, I want to open this up to the audience. You've been patiently sitting and listening to all of my questions, so let's take some questions from the audience. I see there is a gentleman in the front and a gentleman in the back, and this lady. Why don't we take a round of three questions at once now? And if you don't mind identifying yourself as you ask your question, thanks.
Peter Humphrey, I'm an intel analyst and former diplomat. I do a lot of black swan prediction, and I'm wondering how bulletproof is the deconfliction effort between the coalition and Iranian forces on the ground in Iraq. For example, does CENTCOM have a hotline to the Quds force? And more importantly, if during the retaking of Anbar and Mosul, we were to accidentally kill dozens or hundreds of embedded Pasdaran, how bad would that be? Does it have the potential of unraveling the JCPOA?
Thank you very much, Middle East Institute, for this great discussion. I'm Faye Mokhtader. I'm a Ethnarchy Council member. My question is to the panel. Everybody expects Iran to be a monolithic society, and Iran is not. As you see that in the presidential elections in here, that we are not a monolithic society either. And inflammatory rhetorics coming from Donald Trump does not represent all Americans. Having said that, Rouhani platform was on economic reform. So he needs to deliver to the young people who went to the voting booths to vote for him that they're going to be employed. Iranian youth, which consists about 60% of the Iranian population, are eagerly waiting for the Iranian banks to be connected to the West, international businesses getting to Iran so they can be employed. If we're not going to deliver any economic incentives to the Iranians, and if the bankings are still suffering from transactions, Rouhani will not be able to deliver what he promised. And considering the fact that you mentioned also something about the bank, Iranian banks being involved in money laundering, if you sanction a country for more than two decades, how do you want that country to survive economically? So they're going to obviously use some illegal ways to do business, and this is what they had done. So it is our sanctions that had encouraged black market and money laundering. Thank you very much.
Let's take these first two questions together, and then we'll come back to the other questions in the room. Just on that money laundering point, I want our panel to answer it, but I can address one part of your money laundering point, which is that this is not about them trying to get around banking regulations. That's not what the money laundering accusation is about. The money laundering accusation is about them taking money for one thing and then sending it to the IRGC, sending it to banned entities. So it's not about, oh, we can't use proper banking channels, let's use some illegal banking channels. It's about where the money was destined, where the money was going. So money laundering for illegal entities and illegal activities, illegal. And when I say illegal, I don't mean the U.S. I mean the United Nations calls them illegal activities. That's what the money laundering judgment is about. All right, so let's address these first two questions. First, and this might go first to Paul, about how much coordination between Iran and U.S. coalition forces in Iraq was part of this gentleman's question.
Well, actually, Admiral Miller may be better equipped than I am to talk. But let me focus not so much on the here and now, but the second part of the question in terms of the implications. And I think there would be a substantial hazard with regard to possibly the JCPOA unraveling. There would be people on both sides who never wanted and still don't want an improved U.S.-Iranian relationship, who would assume the worst and make the most of the whole incident. And so you would have people over here saying the Iranians were out, here's another instance of the Iranians, killing American citizens intentionally. And you'd have the same sort of rhetoric and perhaps to a large extent, genuinely, held misperceptions about what the intent was. so that there is that hazard, and I think this underscores the importance of communication. I mean, you're focusing on a strictly military thing, but I think there are all kinds of ways in which the diplomatic channels, such as we saw with the foreign ministers when the the boat strayed into Iranian waters, can help defuse this kind of thing. So it's an appropriate worry.
Thank you, Admiral Mill. Can you address the issue of any coordination against ISIS that might be going on?
We don't have a good way to coordinate with the militias, the Shia militias that are not specifically associated with the government. So if you go back to the time right after the invasion of Iraq, when Ayatollah Sistani called on all Iranian or all Iraqis to unite to repel this invasion, there were quite a few Shia that formed militias that are actually part of the government, and that fight in conjunction with the Iraqi military. So we have good coordination with them because they're part of the Iraqi military. But there are also, as everyone knows, a number of Shia militia that are not associated with the government, and that are independent militias. And many of those militias are actually more closely aligned with Iran. And we don't have good coordination with them. And so, I'm trying to remember the exact name of the town, but there was a battle, where actually the Revolutionary Guard, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard went to liberate a city. It was not supported by U.S. air power. This is about a year ago, because we didn't have an ability to coordinate with them. And the initiative stalled. And so the prime minister took the initiative and said,
Ramadi,
thank you. And the Revolutionary Guard troops actually pulled out. And then regular Iraqi troops then went in. They were supported by Shia militia troops that were coordinated with and aligned with the government. And then U.S. air power came in, and the liberation was eventually successful. But it is a concern in that, the U.S. can't support, or the coalition can't support troops on the ground that we can't talk to and can't coordinate with. So they've got to be closely aligned with the Iraqi army itself. So where that will have an effect, obviously, is in further operations in Anbar, and most specifically in Mosul, and how that operation in Mosul occurs, and what troops actually take part.
I just want to touch on it, but it also gets back to an earlier point. It is true that we have a converging interest with the Iranians when it comes to dealing with ISIS, but we tend to diverge in Iraq because we want to see an inclusive government, and the Iranians clearly have made it very difficult to produce an inclusive government. You look at polling. I read a poll, I think, the week before last that showed 93% of the Sunnis don't want to be liberated by Shia militias in Iraq. And some of the largest Shia militias, some who are, I think, making life difficult for the Iraqi government right now, and I'm not talking about Sadr, they are also claiming they're going to be part of the liberation. So you see a kind of tension here, and it's not just the tension you're talking about. You're seeing about a tension about what the future of Iraq is going to be and what the role of Iran is in that. It's not to say they may have a role, but the question is, are they prepared to help? And I don't see them helping right now.
Alex, would you be able to address the lady's question about Iran is not a monolith, and what about the suppressed expectations of youth? How's the government going to meet those expectations for a growing economy and a growing middle class?
That's a very important question, obviously. But again, as I was trying to say, there is no agreement on the basics. I mean, it's easy to focus on what's happening in the banking sector. And it will take time to undo what was done over the last few years in terms of sanctioning Iran. I wouldn't give up hope on that front just yet. But frankly, the Iranian economy has bigger issues to worry about as we go forward. Let me give you a very, very specific example on the conflict in terms of path forward within the system. The Iran oil contract. what they call the IPC, the Iran Petroleum Contracts. It's been discussed now over 2 years, and to this day, we don't know if the Iranian oil minister Zanghani can pull through and have it approved within the Iranian parliament. Long story short, who is opposed to it? The IRGC, which has got 20-25% of the Iranian economy. One of the things to remember is IRGC often talks in terms of narrative and messaging about Iran's sovereignty, fighting all imperialism, all the rest of it. But you actually look harder. They're worried about getting hit in their pockets. They have a very nice control over good aspects of the Iranian economy. The lucrative energy sector is part of that, oil and gas. I mean, how can you not? Largest natural gas reserves in the world and the second largest oil reserves in the world happen to be in Iran. Lucrative. And they're fighting the Rouhani government on this issue. But Rouhani hasn't given up yet. So he keeps talking about the so-called win-win formula. He says, I mean, I don't know how more explicit the man can be. He says, my brothers, don't worry. There will be money for everyone. Don't put obstacles front of the path of bringing foreign investment. And they want something like $30 to $50 billion per year and GDP growth of 8%, going from about 4% now. So he's got some great ambitions. But before we talk about the role of the U.S. and the bank, you know, they need to figure out what kind of society do they want. I mean, fundamentally, that's what that's the problem here. What are you? Are you the 1979 Ayatollah Khomeini Islamic Republic, or have you gotten over that and you're looking forward?
All right, so let's get some more questions. This was the gentleman in the back who I pointed to before. Am I right? Okay. So let's have him go ahead and identify yourself and with your question.
Keith Weissman. I'm in the 12-step program to withdraw from being part of the blob. It's a question for anybody who wants to answer it. You know, Dennis, you mentioned the talk about, and Alex too, that the Iranians need to ask themselves questions and about their, what kind of society they have. And I was just wondering about the idea of reciprocity, of a mirror image, that of what they might see when they look at us. And certainly, as any observer from overseas would say, it is pretty wild what's going on here in terms of the debate on Iran and looking back in history. I mean, I don't think the Iranians have ever shot down an American passenger airline. I mean, we can go back and list all these crimes that everyone else did and each other did to each other back 50 years. And where does that get us?
It's basically, how do the Iranians see the United States?
I want to just raise it. Is there any effort of people who are making policy, some of you who are involved in this, to sort of understand that part of the question? Because that's just as important as our own perception to them.
Okay.
Right?
Thank you. I'm Benjamin Tua. This may be primarily for Admiral Miller. Given your observations about coordination or lack of it on the ground and some of the naval incidents that you cited, how do you see the possible utility of incidents at sea agreement, either bilaterally or multilaterally, and how likely would that be in the coming period?
And let's take one more question into this group here. This gentleman here. We'll get to the others.
Thanks very much. I'm Garrett Mitchell, and I write the Mitchell Report. And I want to pose a question that goes back to the title of the session itself, which is U.S.-Iran policy in a shifting regional. And in this context, which is, if we are learning anything, I find myself in rooms like this recently, listening to conversations that I like a lot and I'm interested in. But I keep thinking about the messages that we're getting, whether we like it or not, from the presidential primary process that's been taking place. It's clear, if anything is clear, it's that there are certainly attitudes, the volume of which we won't know for some time, but there are attitudes out there that would have would have little interest in this discussion and little faith in what was being is being said. There's that sort of, whatever you want to call it, nativist time to bring the boys home, et cetera, set of attitudes that are popular on both sides, or I should say both ends of the spectrum, and who knows how far in. So it leads me to this question, which was, we've had a very interesting discussion about Iran and Yemen and Iraq and the Saudi Arabia-Iran conflict. But if we were to walk out of here today and were to be asked, well, what were the two or three things that this panel said should be the primary planks of our Iran policy going forward, what would the panel say those might be?
Thank you, Garrett. All right, so I'm going to put two of those questions together. The one is, well, Alex, first maybe you can address, what does Iran see when they look at us? And I think that the gentleman was implicitly asking not only about our actions, but also about our presidential process, was the impression I got. Yeah, no, okay, well, what Iran sees what does Iran see when they see us? So maybe you could address that. Dennis, I'd like you to address the presidential process, and that goes to Garrett's question about nativist tendencies. Candidate Trump was just here, recently in the Mayflower talking about America first as his slogan. And so if one were advising either Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, what would this panel say to them in terms of Iran policy? Let's address those two together first, then we can get to the incidents at sea agreement.
Thank you. I guess the answer in some ways depends on your answer to the question, was the hostage crisis in 1979 the right thing to do or not? If you're one of the ones today, 37 years later, who says, actually, that was a great revolution thing to do, you're probably going to focus on the United States and think they're just looking for excuses to bring the Islamic Republic down. And I think certainly Ayatollah Khamenei belongs to that school of thought. And every time that the U.S. says that upsets him and people around him, They will say, you know, they're vindicated. You look at someone like Rouhani or his mentor, Ayatollah Rafsanjani, they will say, actually, in retrospect, taking over the embassy was a mistake. And that what we picked up, in terms of fighting the United States for almost four decades now has come at huge cost for the nation of Iran. But they're still hopeful. They're hopeful and thinking there are people in the United States that you can have dealings with, and it might work out. Now, nobody talks about the great old days of alliances that United States and Iran had from 1941 to 1979, but still you don't have to have the state of relations you have today. One thing I say, though, which I think is so telling, a speech that the Secretary of State Madeleine Albright gave in 2000, I think it was Asia Society, she talked about Iran and then divided their leadership into the good mullahs and the bad mullahs. Now, I can tell you Ayatollah Khamenei paid attention to that speech, and he knew he was in the bad mullah category. Now, you got to make sure he doesn't feel that way anymore, because if he does, he's going to keep putting obstacles in the path forward.
So I'm glad you mentioned her speech, because in answer to your question, because she also – that's not the only thing she said in that speech. The problem is – when she made a reference to mistakes we made in the past in that speech. But of course, because she, in the speech, she also made the reference to the good and the bad mullahs, the part where she was kind of acknowledging the role that we had played back in 52 with Mossadegh, that got lost. But in answer to your question, the point is, yes, different administrations made an effort to try to see how the Iranians see it, why they see it a certain way, of course. Madeleine's speech was part of that. Obviously, in this administration, what has been done, what has been said, how the effort at the nature of outreach from the very beginning, try to take that into account. There's a reality on the Iranian side. And, you know, what Alex was just describing, you've got a kind of bifurcation over there. those who want to see the worst in American behavior, whatever we do, they're going to continue to interpret it that way because it serves the way they want to define the Islamic Republic, which also goes to enhance their continuing control. Yeah, but okay, but you asked a question. I'm giving you an answer. You can choose to like the answer or not like the answer. So anyway, I'm just saying, you know, there's always a value to try to understand how someone else sees what you're doing. But you also shouldn't be so concerned by that that necessarily it gets you thinking only about their sense of grievance and not also where they're doing things that are wrong. And this gets me to what I would give in terms of advice. The advice would be, what was the logic of the approach that the administration adopted in trying to get to negotiations with the Iranians? There was an initial effort at outreach, which the Iranians turned down, right, at the very beginning of the administration, a serious effort at outreach, which they turned down. And then the approach became one of, we will build the pressure on the Iranians, but we will leave them a way out. That was the logic of the sanctions. It wasn't to put them in a corner where they had no way out, but it was to raise the cost to them of what they were doing on their nuclear program. I would say the same logic should continue to apply. We should make sure that they live up to the terms of the agreement. We should live up to our obligations in the agreement as well. And when it comes to their behaviors in the region which are destabilizing and which are threatening, we should find ways to make it clear there's a cost for that. Again, leaving them a way out.
Admiral, can you address the question about – I'm sorry, you wanted to say something
yes,
at all about
that? Yes, I do. I think Keith Weissman makes an extremely important point, and it's a continuation of a point that Dennis made earlier when he was talking about, you know, the Gulf Arabs and how even if we are our interests are different, we have to understand, you know, how they perceive us. The same logic applies to the Iranians. And no matter where the other party is on the spectrum of – adversary versus partner, the same logic applies. And I don't think we have taken account. We may understand it in one sense, but we haven't taken account of how many of the things we do affect the perceptions over in Iran that in turn affect our interests. I mean, just to cite one example, the moves in Congress to change the visa waiver program in a way that, as the Iranians saw it, I think with very good reason, was telling businesses all over Europe and Asia, if you want to still have smooth, visa-free travel to the United States to do business here, you better not go to Iran to do business there. It's no surprise that the Iranians, call them moderates or hardliners alike, scream foul with regard to that would be a violation of, you know, our obligations under the JCPOA not to pile on, you know, more economic damage. I don't think we've thought about that enough. It's not just the friends and partners. I think Keith makes a very important point.
Admiral Miller, can you address the question about an incidents at sea agreement? Would it be useful or plausible?
I can, but before I do that, just to drive that particular question down to the tactical level, one of the things we used to do, and I assume they still do out at Fifth Fleet, is we would look at every day what we looked like to the Iranians. In an attempt to make sure that we weren't over-pressurizing the situation in the Gulf. And I think it's an important point to, you know, how do we look to them? In terms of the incident at sea agreement, kind of a little known fact, CENTCOM doesn't have a hotline, with the Iranians, but we did at NAVCENT. We had a hotline. And we had a couple of Farsi speakers on call in case they actually called us up and it was somebody that didn't speak English. In the 39 months that I was there, we used it one time and it was a trick. They called us on a rescue, line and we told them to call back. Some smart, fast thinking lieutenant said, no, call back on this number. So they called back on the hotline. That's the only time they actually ever used it and they didn't know they were using it. But a little known fact is U.S. sailors talk to Iranian sailors, whether they be RevGuard sailors or regular, Iranian regular Navy sailors every single day. We interact with them. It's a small body of water. They're at sea all the time. We're at sea all the time. And we deal with them. And we deal with them in a professional way. There are professional rules of the road. There are ways to deal with one another. And we're able to do that without incident. So this riverine craft incident that happened near Farsi Island a couple of months ago was really kind of an outlier. And we're able to deal with them
we rescue Iranian sailors, by and large, civilian sailors that come into harm's way on a routine basis, and it's not a very big deal. One of the things that happened while I was there, we actually refueled an Iranian Coast Guard craft that was at sea. They were involved in a rescue. It was a complex rescue. It went on for a long time. Their Coast Guard called us up. They said, hey, we need to refuel our ship. We don't have enough fuel to make it back into port. And we refueled them at sea. Didn't ask permission. Didn't go back to CENTCOM. Didn't go back to anybody in Washington, D.C. to ask a question we didn't want to hear an answer to. So do we need an INCSI agreement? You know, I don't think so, because, you know, sailors can get along with sailors without incident, generally speaking, and we're able to do that. What was different between us and the Soviet Union back in the day is we used to have interactions that were not standard, as the ambassador might well remember. We avoid those kind of interactions with the Iranians, and by and large, the Iranians avoid those kind of interactions with us.
Very interesting to hear that there's interactions are going on every single day and, for the most part, very successfully. I promised this man one last question, so we'll take his question in the back. If you identify yourself first, please.
Thank you. I'm Namo Abdullah, a journalist with RUDA, which is a Kurdish news agency in Iraq. I just have a question along the lines whether Iran's quote-unquote bad activities have increased as a result of the nuclear deal in the Middle East. And if all of you can actually answer this question, I'd be very grateful. The Iraqi Kurds now are planning to hold an independence referendum, and they are very serious about it. I wonder whether, as a result of this nuclear deal, which could allow Iran to join the world community, Iran is in a stronger or weaker position to prevent Kurdish statehood. Thank you.
Okay, who would like to take that?
I'll give it a, you know, as you know, the Iranians have been more than happy for the autonomous Kurdish region in northern Iraq going back to the early 1990s. They would like to see that continue. I think independence for them, Kurdish independence, and this is a policy that goes back obviously to the days of the Shah, is not a good development. How hard they're going to fight it, I don't know. Will it be a key priority? I doubt it. Much will depend on Iranian-Turkish relations as we go forward. But, you know, my reading, you know this better than I, but my reading of Kurdish politics is, sure, the Iraqi Kurds don't want to upset the Iranians. Will try and sort of use Iran when necessary. I mean, Iran came to their aid nicely back in summer of 2014. I believe it was the first country that actually came to KRG's aid fighting ISIS with actual physical ammunition and so forth. But look, someone like Mr. Barzani has made it very clear his future, the way he sees it for Iraqi Kurdistan, isn't going to be one that's close to the Islamic Republic of Iran. And I think if you take that at face value, that in itself tells you a fair amount about the future of Iranian Kurdish-Iraqi relations.
Spoke earlier about whether Iran's actions have changed since the nuclear deal, but if anyone would like to put a finer point on it, please.
I'll make just two quick points. One, I think it really is too early to tell. They've done some things that we think are a little bit inflammatory, but you have to, as is always the case, you have to listen to what Iran says, then you have to watch what Iran does. And I think it's still too early to tell. On the Kurdish issue, one of the things I will say, you know, the Kurds have fought brilliantly against ISIL thus far. They've also taken land that isn't traditionally Kurdish land. They're likely to take more. And one of the things that we haven't talked enough about, but we will eventually have to talk about, is how do we sort through all that when the fighting is all done.
So please join me in thanking our panel for their insight.